You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
From the rolling bluffs of the Driftless region to the pristine shorelines of Superior in Michigan, from the Northwoods to the Kettle Moraine, Civic Media broadcasts across all of Wisconsin. For all of Wisconsin. Take a trip with us across the radio network to hear from communities throughout the state. This is the Civic Media Spotlight.
Beginning this week's Civic Media Spotlight, we'll go to a segment from Matt and Air on Air. Jane and Greg were joined by Dr. Kristen Lyerly, along with Laurel Marcinkus, a woman who went through a horrific experience while carrying a wanted pregnancy. In this deeply personal discussion, the group advocates for women's healthcare rights.
Good morning. Welcome to Matt and Air on Air. Jane Matt and Air, Greg Mach, and Calvin Butenoff coming to you live from our studio at Radio Park in Racine. You can always join us. Call or text. The number is the same, 855-752-4842. You can leave a comment if you're watching on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and what used to be Twitter after 11:30. We're going to light it up a little bit. We like to take a little break. Take a breath.
Audio sorbet.
He's working on it. We have a sound effect for that.
Yeah. Oh.
You got it, Kelvin?
That was the sound effect that was in my head.
Audio sorbet.
I feel like, Dr. Lyerly, that sound effect is always in your head. So.
We're going to talk about whether or not you read. Do you read? Do you read books? Do you read articles? Or do you get your information some other way? The Atlantic has a big article about Americans are not reading. Some of us are. Bookstores still exist. But we'll kick that around, and then we will wrap it up as we always do with This Shouldn't Be a Thing. Today it is the Royal Flush Edition, courtesy of Greg Mach, who found that Tisbat, as we like to call them. Right now, though, we are joined by Dr. Kristen Lyerly. She is our chief morale officer here at Civic Media, and we're going to talk about something tragically that's very serious and is having ramifications around the country since Roe was overturned. This is from an article in ProPublica, and the headline reads, Texas banned abortion, then sepsis rates soared. Pregnancy got far more dangerous in Texas after the state banned abortion in 2021. The rate of sepsis shot up more than 50% for women hospitalized when they lost a pregnancy in the second trimester. Dr. Lyerly, explain to us, first of all, what is sepsis?
Sepsis is an infection that's very serious and difficult to treat. And it can cause lifelong injury, it can cause organ damage, and it can cause death. And for that reason, when someone's water breaks early in pregnancy, before viability, before the fetus can survive, the general guidelines based on evidence and experience are that we offer our patients a broad number of options, but one of them is termination of pregnancy. And the goal is to save the woman's life. But what we've seen in Texas, and remember, Texas is the canary in the coal mine,
yep,
because they had abortion laws before Roe fell. So what we see in Texas is what we expect to see in other places. And what we're seeing in Texas is that when this happens to women, doctors are not able to offer them this option. They have to wait until the fetal heart stops beating, or until the woman starts to show signs that she's becoming critically ill. And that is, from a physician's perspective, from a human perspective, that is unbelievable, unforgivable.
Only women would be treated this way. I'm sorry, but only women would be treated with this attitude of, I don't know, you're not close enough to death yet, so we can't treat you. You need to be closer to death before we can give you the life-saving treatment that you need. A man would never be in this position, in whether or not it's reproductively involved or not. This would never happen to a man?
I can't think of a situation where a man would be involved. And, you know, this is so striking and it's so devastating. You may have heard of the story of Amanda Zarowski. Mm-hmm. Amanda is a woman from Texas, from Austin, who this happened to her. And this was, she had a desired pregnancy, a deeply desired pregnancy that she lost. And she almost died as a result of that. She's been very outspoken. She's actually one of Time Magazine's Women of the Year. She's coming to Wisconsin to tell her story, actually, in March, in the middle of next month. But here in Wisconsin, there are plenty of these stories. And I have the honor, as a physician and an advocate, of getting to know some of these women. You know, I've treated many women who have been in this situation. And some of these women are so courageous to step up and share their stories. One of them is with us today. Her name is Laurel. She's from southeastern Wisconsin. Laurel, tell us about what happened to you and how you've been able to cope with it.
Right. Well, first of all, I just want to say hi, everybody. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, Laurel.
It's really wonderful to be with you. I'm a little nervous, but I'm
here just talking to us. You're just talking to us. It's all good.
Okay. So, So as you alluded to, I am one of those women. In the fall of 2022, I became pregnant. And in the first trimester of that pregnancy, I was diagnosed with a blood clot in my uterus that caused me to bleed vaginally for weeks. And initially with that diagnosis, doctors were confident that the blood clot would actually end up resolving itself eventually. But unfortunately, that didn't end up happening, and something really bad ended up happening because around between week 20 and 21, the blood clot caused my water to break too soon. It caused it to break early. And then it also caused something called a placental abruption. And for those who don't know what that is, it's when the placenta tears away from the wall of the uterus. And this can be a life-threatening condition. So my doctors basically told me that my labor needed to be induced in order for my life to be saved. At that time, and that is considered to be an abortion.
Right.
And at that time, the law in Wisconsin stated, well, basically we were at the time under a near total abortion ban. But the law did state that in the case of the life of the mother, when the life of the mother is threatened, an abortion is warranted. But there were hurdles, legal hurdles that I and we had to jump through first. For example, in order for me to receive the care I needed and for my labor to be induced, I had to undergo two different evaluations. So I had to be evaluated by a doctor initially, and they had to confirm my condition, and I had to have an ultrasound. And then I had my condition had to be confirmed by a second doctor with a second ultrasound and confirmed again. And I ended up waiting a substantial amount of time in order to, throughout that entire process, I ended up having to wait. I can't really, I still to this day, I'm not really sure why I had to wait, but I believe the water broke and I had the placental abruption at around 6 p.m. at night, and I wasn't induced until the following day, late afternoon. So I had to sit there and I was bleeding. And as I've, as Kristen and I have talked extensively about this, and as I've told her, I had already been bleeding for weeks because I had been bleeding vaginally. Then I had the placental abruption and I was bleeding internally and bleeding vaginally as well. So I was just sitting there and I was bleeding and bleeding. And then a key component of my story is that my baby, my daughter, she was still alive. She was still alive and healthy because she wasn't the issue. It was the anatomy surrounding her with the placenta and the blood clot. So once my labor was induced, my daughter was actually born alive. And she died in my arms 2 hours after birth.
Oh, Laurel, I am just heartbroken for you. I am so, so sorry that you had to go through what you went through to get the care that you needed. Dr. Lyerly, was there any reason she should have had to wait? Is there any reason she should have had to gone to two separate doctors to perform the same examinations in order to get the care that she needed to save her life?
No. And in fact, this is sadly not an uncommon situation. I've dealt with this in the little rural hospital where I work. Actually, I dealt with it recently, within the last month. This is a common thing, and we know how to diagnose it. We know how to treat it. We know how to counsel our patients. So this delay was completely unnecessary. But the one thing Laurel didn't tell you, and I'll leave this to her, is her memory of those 2 hours that she got to spend with her baby. Laurel, tell us.
Yeah, so by the time my labor was induced and I was able to be with my daughter, I was so sick at that point that I don't have much recollection of her life within those 2 hours and my time with her. And something that I've talked to Kristen about extensively is that something that was really important to me is that I knew that she was going to die once I gave birth, and so it was important to me that she was baptized before she passed away, and I have no recollection of that baptism at all.
I'm not surprised. First of all, because of the physical state that you were in, but I can't even imagine your emotional state, and knowing while you're waiting for the treatment that you need in order to stay alive, the agony that you must have been in. I can't even imagine that, Laurel.
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely terrifying, absolutely devastating. And something that was really devastating for me is as I was sitting there waiting, bleeding, I could feel my baby moving in my stomach, knowing that I was going to have to give birth to her and watch her die. And I had to wait, and having that extended out was just added trauma.
And you know what we can do and what we should do in these situations, and what we do in states that don't have abortion bans, is we surround people like Laurel and her family with support, with information, with love, so that they can get through this traumatic time in their lives in the best possible way. And what abortion bans cause, in addition to harming people and putting people's lives at risk, is they take that experience away from you and they cause permanent emotional trauma. Families, yes, are ripped apart by this.
Yes, for certain. And I, the PTSD I dealt with for months and months afterwards was absolutely unimaginable. It was so bad mentally that I almost considered hospitalization at one point.
Oh, Laurel.
Because I just couldn't function afterwards. It was so bad.
We're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Kristen Lyerly and Laurel, who is brave enough to share her very painful story with us. Please stay close. You are listening to Matt and Air on Air, coming to you across the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Matt and Air on Air is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs across the network weekday mornings from 10 till noon. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Next up on the Civic Media Spotlight, we'll go to Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Pat's talking theater this week. That is political theater, along with Joan Esposito, Mark Jacob, and James Santel. They hand out awards for the actors, comedies, and dramas taking place by politicians in the U.S. government.
It was on this week, 1984, that Thriller won like all the Grammys, including Album of the Year. So we're playing some cuts off there on this Friday morning here on Up North News Radio across the Civic Media Radio Network, just about 7:22 right now. And it's going to be fun. It's going to be a bit of a stretch, but it's Oscar weekend. So we're going to have a little fun with political theater. And if they gave out Oscars for some of these categories, what would you do with them? So I'm going to ask my Week in Review panel to talk all about that. That, of course, includes former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel, who also hosts Amicus Saturday mornings at 9 across the Civic Media Radio Network. And then we've got two folks from Chicago, Mark Jacob, who's worked for the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times. And pinch hitting for Jennifer Schulze, who's off traveling this week, is WCPT radio broadcaster Joan Esposito, who joins us from the Windy City as well. Jim's connection is a little haywire right now, but we'll see if we can get him back on. In the meantime, Mark, Joan, good morning. How are you?
Doing good fine. Morning.
Joan, it's so nice to be with you, having been on your show multiple times. It's nice to thank you so much for getting up early and joining us over here today.
You're very, very welcome. And, you know, in addition to the Oscars and the Grammys, I just want to say today is my anniversary. So there's three reasons to celebrate.
Wow. Okay. We got all kinds of reasons here. Where do we want to start with all this? Because there's so much going on and you know, there's people who have been good supporters, who have been good actors, who have been bad actors at all of this. Let me start with this one first, Mark, because it's the most obvious one. Best comedy. The award for best comedy this week has to go to Susan Collins for claiming that she was appalled that in the United Nations vote about the war in Ukraine, that the Trump administration sided with Russia. It's good comedy out of Susan Collins, but Mark, nobody's laughing anymore at this stuff.
Well, Pat, everyone has learned their lesson because, you know, they always do learn their lesson, you know. And everyone gives, you know, Susan Collins is constantly amazed by everything. You know, she wakes up in a new world every day. You know, you mean the Trump administration likes Putin? Wow, I can't believe this. You know, I can't believe she won her last election, and I don't know what she's going to do next time. But it's like, you know. In some ways, someone like Tommy Tuberville, who you know exactly where he's coming from, and he's, you know, going to say a bunch of crazy crap and all that. In some ways, that to me, that's preferable than somebody who pretends to be a moderate but always ends up on the side of the right wing, like Susan Collins, and always acts like she's standing up for decency, but never ends up on that, you know, doing it, really.
Well, that really, when it comes down to acting, Joan, that's really what we're talking about here, is there is just so much acting, which I know feeds the cynicism that people have about politics, but that doesn't mean we should accept the cynicism. We shouldn't accept the bad acting. We should call these kinds of things out. Definitely the kind of thing that you do on your afternoon show in Chicago is to people are trying to be, they say they want to be moderate. Their actions don't show that at all.
We call out the obvious bad behavior, but what really gets me is, you know, and I'm sure you've had this experience too, Pat, you privately talk to a Republican or you interview somebody who's knows Republicans and they trust to speak privately, and they don't even believe what they're voting for and what they're doing. Privately, they'll say, well, you know, Trump is a danger. Publicly, they're like, well, I'm behind Trump 100%. That's the worst kind of acting. That's the kind of acting that just drives me crazy, because I feel that Donald Trump himself is less dangerous than the people in elected office who are enabling him, because those are the people who have the potential to slow him down, if not rein him in. And they're acquiescing. You know, I'm reading a book about how democracies fall, and, you know, Thailand, and what happened in Germany, and just, you know, countries all across the world, all across recent history of the last 120 years. And it is the enablers who really bring down democracy, not the tyrants themselves. So that's the acting that I want to call out.
And that enabling can come not just from, you know, sycophants and minions and yes men, but Jim Santel, it also does come from some parts of the judiciary as well. You know, some folks on the Supreme Court come to mind, for example, who are acting as justices but appear to be politicians in judicial robes. But then there are still the occasional moments that tell us maybe things aren't all lost. You've got yet another federal judge ordered the Trump administration on Thursday to retract the directives that prompted the firing of thousands of federal workers, saying that they were illegal and suggesting the layoffs be stopped. That's fine for one judge to say, Jim, but I have a feeling this, like so many other Trumpian court things, is going to be caught in a long, hard slog before anything is resolved.
Certainly will be. And to follow up on your theme, I would offer, Pat, to your good thoughts, that some of the best supporting actors out there right now, those who are keeping the guardrails up to some extent, are those federal judges out there. This is William Alsup, Northern District of California, who just last night said, you know what? You do not have the legislative, you don't have the regulatory authority to do what you're doing. And for that reason, stop it. Now, again, those statements are important. They are should be consumed by every American. To your point, we also have an appellate process. And all these decisions, including those other judges who are also saying, oh, by the way, you can't not do what I tell you to do. They're making some findings about contempt. All these things will be subject to appeals, to courts of appeals. Some of this, it's already percolating up to some degree to the Supreme Court. Ultimately, the big non-supporting major actor, again, comes from last July, when the United States Supreme Court, at the pen of John Roberts, told Donald Trump that he's got this massive authority to do what he can do. That's a major player in any movie, including the horrific movie that's going on in America right now.
So quite some political theater here, to which I would offer as we head into break here, that there does need to be an award for worst supporting actor. And that has to be J.D. Vance, who somehow believes in his mind he's still the vice president of the United States when we actually have co-presidencies going on here. What happened to J.D. Vance? I guess he's just sent overseas to occasionally make wildly inappropriate speeches. But we'll continue this conversation with our panel, Joan Esposito from WCPT Radio in Chicago, Mark Jacob, who has the Stop the Presses newsletter, Jim Santel, former U.S. attorney who hosts Amicus here on the Civic Media Radio Network. That discussion continues right after this break. I'm Pat Kreitlow. You're up north.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow is affiliated with the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on select Civic Media stations weekday mornings from 6 until 8. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
Welcome back to the Civic Media Spotlight. Up next, we'll go to the Todd Alba Show. This week, Todd welcomed on newly elected State Senator Sarah Kieski to talk about a right to repair bill that she co-authored. She believes that farmers should be allowed to repair their own equipment. Common sense, right?
Pursuing truth wherever it may lead and having fun doing it. Welcome back to the Todd Alba Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Glad to have you along. 34 minutes now past the hour of 1 o'clock on this Wednesday, February 26, 2025. Getting a few texts in that may be having audio troubles on some of our platforms, but I believe though we're on that, and Zomer, that our great engineering team is aware of it. We're correcting it if it has not been corrected already. Fixed. Very good. Fantastic, guys. We always appreciate the great work of Zomers and all of our engineers. Thanks for the great discussion last segment as well. We'll try to sneak into what's worse before the end of the show here, but right now we are joined by new freshman state senator from the 14th district here in the state of Wisconsin, Sarah Kieski, who is from the, we'll call it south central part of the state, but reaches over into the old neighborhood there in Richland County. And she is here in person for those watching on stream, YouTube, Facebook, whatnot. It's great, Senator, to have you here in person, and kind of one of the advantages we have only being a block away from the Capitol.
Yeah, it's a really easy little commute I had.
Well, welcome to the show. We met last summer, fall, when you were campaigning down in Muscogee, Wisconsin. For those that don't know, that's just south of Richland County. And there was a listening session there, and it was regarding the closure of the two-year campus at Richland Center.
And you were there along with now former Representative Katrina Shanklin and Senator Royce as well. And I was so impressed that even though you weren't a senator yet, you took time out of your campaign to listen and then to give your viewpoint. And I think regardless of partisan politics, that so many people in Wisconsin are just looking for an elected official who will legit listen and then hear what they're saying. Is that what you attribute to part of your, you knocked off an incumbent, which is not an easy thing to do. Do you attribute your listening skills to part of your victory?
I guess you would have to ask the voters, right, fully, but I think people did experience from me a sense that I really do care and I do really want to hear from them. Just who I am as a person that has always worked in the service field of being a counselor, my greatest skill probably is listening and trying to hear the heart of what is going on for somebody. And so I brought that to the table just because that's who I am. And so I think it is, as somebody that wants to be in service to people, that skill I think is a little bit underrepresented and much needed. So I think people appreciated it a lot. And hopefully that was one of the reasons.
Your district, the 14th, I call it an eclectic district. Maybe that's not the right word, but it stretches from basically the east side of Madison and then north, kind of along the interstate, and then encompasses, goes west into parts of Sauk County, into my home county of Richland County in southwest Wisconsin. You're originally from Lodi. Is that where you grew up at?
No, I grew up in a small town called Cashton, Wisconsin. Yeah.
Know exactly where Cashton is.
Oh, really? Yeah. So, when I grew up, it was about 850 or so was the population. Now I think it might be 1,000. So a really small town in Monroe County. Mm-hmm. But I've lived in Lodi now since 2017.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cashton, for those who don't know, just north of Richland County, kind of south of La Crosse, and Organic Valley Dairy has expanded there, and it's a huge part of their economy out there in Cashton. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you live in Lodi. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what led you to run for the state senate.
Yeah. So my background is, like I said, I grew up on a dairy farm. And so I was really deeply entrenched in living in small rural Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And all that entails, right? It means you know the neighbors, you know the business of the neighbors, you also help the neighbors when things are going wrong. You grow up in a small rural school, which is really the bedrock then of that community. I went off to study. I have a master's degree in counseling psychology, and I've worked for 25 years doing counseling services for individuals, couples, and families. And that's just been my passion for all these years. I've just loved my work. But with the changes in the political landscape, I became more concerned about the world I was leaving my children and bringing our children into, and became increasingly more active in just the political realm and wanting to do my part. And that transitioned into starting a nonprofit when COVID hit our small community, because it really seemed to divide us in a way that was so unfortunate. Both because I think we all were choosing to live there because we care about that small connected piece that we were seeking in that that rural lifestyle. But with the changes and the pulls of political division, there's just so much rancor. And I was then seeing where I brought my children, where I was raising them, it became kind of a hostile environment. And I just felt so compelled to just do whatever I could. As a mental health provider, that meant, how do you help people feel better? How do you help people care about each other? So it was really just this idea of then focusing on how do we work together? How do we uplift our environment? It was called Lift Lodi. It was really coming together in service of one another. And from that, I inadvertently just got on the radar of people that said, hey, Sarah, will you do more? Because we like what you stand for. We like what you're trying to do, your mission of service.
And so initially I was asked to run in an unwinnable assembly district. And I said, well, why would I ever
I've been
do
there. Yeah.
Well, good for you then, because you know how hard it is to run, you know, and so then it's just a passion project, really. Yeah. So that's what I was willing to do. Again, I was so concerned about what was happening on the national level, local level. And so I said, yeah, I will do that because, again, that's my way to serve. So I was doing that, and then the new maps came about. And then I thought, okay, good. Now people do want to run in that district because it became more winnable, possibly. And I was then, after a lot of people had conversations that I didn't know anything about, I was asked, would I be willing to instead move to run for the Senate? Mm-hmm. And I think that really just came from people seeing who I was, seeing what I stood for, and getting behind that. And I really, it honestly is really kind of this unbelievable journey that I didn't expect. And now, like, about a year later, here I am. Yeah. And it's amazing. And I would have never predicted it, but it feels absolutely like the right place to be.
Well, I just appreciate you sharing your story. We all have a journey. And from what I've seen, this is a very grassroots thing. And you're an authentic person. You're genuine. You are who you are. And I think that really connects with people. We're talking to State Senator Sarah Kieske, a new freshman here, Democrat we'll call it Southwest, South Central Wisconsin. One of your first bills here, you're co-sponsoring, Senator, is something that I didn't even really know we needed until I kind of dug into this. It's called Right to Repair. Tell folks why this is needed and why you're a co-sponsor.
So, yeah, so it's something that I did hear on the campaign trail. And I, too, was quite fascinated by it, because when I was growing up, again, on the small farm that we had, my dad just repaired his own equipment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what he did. You know, right. Every small engine, he jimmy-rigged a lot of things. He was like the natural MacGyver. So to me, when I learned about this, I didn't even quite know, what do you mean? You can't, fix your own equipment. And really, the tools and some of the products that are needed for fixing are now limited to just these dealerships that have sold you the equipment. And so you can't do your own repairs. And so it's cost prohibitive oftentimes to either go through that dealership only, because it's then a bit of a monopoly, right? It limits your choices. And you weren't able initially, now it's gotten better, to have access to those products. Let's say it's a computer program oftentimes now, because this machinery now is this so advanced. But in order to even get access to that, it's in thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. And you've already paid into a piece of equipment that was hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? And so but if you did work on your own equipment, or if you had, a local trusted repair person, that could equate with your warranty is no longer good, right? And so you're kind of stuck. And so this is just an opportunity to say, okay, people should have the right to have access at a fair cost, a fair cost. Not saying that they can't make some profit. I mean, I'm not anti-business, right? Sure. But I am for competition. And so in order to be able to then be able to get access to this and or have a independent mechanic have access to this so that they can work on your equipment. So you can have somebody that you know and have a relationship with, or is closer to you, or is more available at a desperate time of need, because when do tractors maybe break down?
When you need them the most.
When you need them the most, right? No. And when are they needed the most? It's during harvesting, right? Oh. Or planting. Who else is harvesting? Everybody.
Right.
And so if it has happening, then it might be a epidemic, right, of time. And if you have a limited resource of people that can service your equipment, you might be waiting, and you can't wait when you're a farmer.
Right.
You need to be able to have that fixed expeditiously. So that's kind of the concept behind it and why it's so necessary.
Yeah, my granddad was a farmer, Richland County dairy farmer for 40 years, and he had a Minneapolis Moline, and then he was one of the first people who got a Deutz, it was called at the time, one of the first German tractors. He worked on it all the time, and I think he would look at this bill that you are co-sponsoring, the Right to Repair bill, and say, well, this is just common horse sense, as he used to say. But to your point, and we're talking Republican State Senator Sarah Kieski here on her new co-sponsorship of the bill, Right to Repair Bill. I think this would surprise a lot of people. I know State Senator Paff was on Jay Matinair's show yesterday, the day before, talking about this as well, that there are maybe apps available, because so much of this, like our cars now, are computerized. But again, that costs thousands or hundreds of dollars just to download the app. And really, I would think that ag people, agriculture producers, owners of this equipment would say, look, it doesn't matter what party you're from, we should all be able to work on our own equipment without costing thousands of dollars. Have you talked to any Republicans so far in the legislature? Have you gotten a sense that there might be a bipartisan approach to a very common sense bill?
I'm going to remain hopeful.
I like that.
Yes, I'm going to remain hopeful. Mm-hmm. Let's just wait and see. I'm going to cross my fingers because, like you're saying, farmers come in red and blue or purple or indifferent, right? Yeah. And so I don't think this should be a partisan issue. I think it's just understanding this is helping the cornerstone of our economy, right? We're helping those farmers, help them with their costs, which we know we need to, you know, do more to make sure that costs aren't just so going out of reason.
Yeah.
And we also want to be able to have maybe small businesses benefit. So, you know, some mechanic maybe could blossom a new business in a small area where he knows he could have agricultural equipment he could work on. And then it's another opportunity for jobs.
We're coming up about a minute and a half. The time always goes quickly. I know you have other appointments to go to, so we don't want to monopolize your time. But, Senator, is there anything I haven't asked you about your co-sponsorship of the Right to Repair Bill that you believe that listeners should know?
Nothing in particular. I think just understanding, again, it's kind of simple, if you will.
Yeah.
I don't know that we
Common
need to
sense.
Make, yeah, I don't know that we need to make it that complex, right? Mm-hmm. Do people believe that others should have the right to either repair their own equipment at a fair, reasonable cost, have access to the things they need, and or be able to have it with an independent repair person? That just makes good sense. That seems like it helps with, again, access and keeping something from being too monopolized in a way that I don't think is honoring competition in the way that we really do need to in the business field.
Yeah, I agree. Minute left here. Give us a sense. You haven't really had a proper floor session yet other than your inauguration, but what's it like just to be in the building?
Oh my gosh, it's like, it's magnificent. And it's so hard to explain what it's like as a new person because, you know, I walk in and, you know, it's magnificent, but then like the next day you'll notice something else about, you know, like maybe it's the doorknob and how intricately designed it is, right? Or you look at the panels on the walls in this new committee room. I mean, it's just ornate. And then you also, you look at, pictures of the people that have been there. You're
it's
just
great.
Like, it is such a historical moment. It is such a privilege.
Privilege to have you on the show. I'll have you back soon. State Senator Sarah Kieski, thank you so much.
Oh my gosh, it's just my pleasure. Thank you, Todd.
Our pleasure. Come on back. We'll wrap things up after this on Civic Media.
The Todd Alba Show is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs across the network weekdays from noon till 2. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Wrapping up hour one of the Civic Media Spotlight for this week, we'll go to the John and Gordy Show down in Madison. John and Gordy welcomed on Jim Santel, host of Civic Media's Amicus, a law review, to pick his brain about how and why Donald Trump thinks that he is above the law.
It is 7:51. 92.7 WMDX with John and Gordy in the morning. And this portion of the show is being brought to you by Verlo Mattress. The Verlo's President's Sale continues this week, but you better get in there to take advantage of their free 0% financing available for up to 18 months. You can save up to 50% on their adjustable bases. All kinds of great deals going on during the President's Day sale, but it ends at the end of the week at Verlo Mattress, east side location, west side location, and you can get more information at verlo.com. John?
We're talking to Jim Santel, Amicus, a law review. You can listen to that on the weekends from 9 to 11 on Saturday.
Right.
I think there's one part here that is a little confusing for me in that we got rid of, the Supreme Court got rid of the Chevron doctrine, which allowed agencies to have some legal ability to regulate, right, from their departments. And yep, that was switched over to the courts instead. Now they have control over it. But then all of a sudden, Trump came out and said that he is going to be making the decision for everybody. So am I right on this thing? Have we suddenly switched around here? Another?
You are. We're certainly sending mixed signals from Washington, D.C. about who's in control,
yes,
right? Which is a larger theme that I think we're all suffering under. You're absolutely right. And so this is this Loper Bright Enterprises case. It was from very late June of last year. And basically it said that again, no more discretion inside federal judges to determine, to object to go opposite to what the experts are telling us, mm-hmm, right? It was a rejection of the notion we've got people inside agencies who know what they're doing. In some ways, what the president did a week ago today is consistent with that, because he also says that at least with respect to what are called the independent agencies, people say, well, what are those? Geez, you know, the reality is that there are an awful lot of them. The,
yeah,
Federal Trade Commission, huge, right? The National Labor Relations Board, regulates labor. The Federal Communications Commission,
yes,
all kind, maybe even a part of the Federal Reserve, right? All those kinds of things created by Congress to be out there, yes, but they're independent of the executive branch. They can still be in court and judges can still take a look at what they're doing. But the whole notion was they should not be subject to the political whims and the animation of the president. A week ago, he issued one of his many executive orders and said, not just effectively, but realistically, that when it comes to understanding what the law is, you've got it just right, John. Now he is the one, and maybe the attorney general along the way, if she cares to weigh in along the way,
mm-hmm,
that they're the ones who are going to tell us what the law is. And oh, by the way, when it comes to communications policy, labor policy, again, economic policy, the Federal Reserve, many other of these independent agencies created by Congress to be independent, not have this kind of political intervention by the executive. Now he's going to make that decision. And this is right out of Project 2025. It's called the Unitary Executive Theory. I suspect
that's right.
Many of your listeners remember this well. We've talked about it. And it's this notion that there is one executive, it's Donald Trump, and he is responsible for every single decision that's made inside that frankly, the second branch of government there. And that's just not the constitutional design. That is not the legislative design. It's another instance of his running roughshod over what Congress has done, what the Constitution says, and how things work. And it's been in place now for a week. It'll be challenged once again. But to my mind, not in any way diminishing the significance of all of these other things that are outrageous in terms of government actions that he is engaging in. This is the one in which he declares himself the dictator. He says, I am the law. I'm going to tell you what the law is, and nobody else will do that. That, once again, should send shivers up the spines of all of us.
Well, you mentioned, yes, somebody's got to challenge it. Who the heck is going to be able to challenge that particular, you know, I am king?
Right.
Statement. Yeah,
exactly. Huh? Right. And so it's got to happen in the weeds once again. Yeah. National Labor Relations Board. He declares something. He says, this is the labor. These are the labor laws now. These are the employment laws.
Mm-hmm.
And someone who is aggrieved by that's got to run into court and say, no, they're not. But individually, again, all these specific and separate agencies will come under review then. And we'll have, we've got something like, well, more than 70 lawsuits. This promises to spawn even more. And in the meantime, we depend upon federal judges once again to stop it. And we also have a president who says, federal judges, who are they? Mm-hmm. No, I'm the president. I will do what I want. This is a mix of great, great concern. People talk about the coming authoritarianism. It's here.
Yeah.
It's here.
Yeah. And this has been well researched for years by all of these conservative organizations and groups. This is the culmination of what they have been working on. Project 2025 was just an incredible piece of documentation. Absolutely incredible.
Right. And again, I hesitate to say to the credit, because it's not to the credit of anybody in America on the face of the planet, but they're prepared. And you're right. This is, again, the unitary executive theory around since Ronald Reagan. And finally, even like presidential immunity, nobody believed that. Now, finally, it's taking hold.
That's right. It was a big deal during the George W. administration, the unitary executive. I thought they really wanted to push it at that point, but didn't have the ability to do it. But Trump, of course, doesn't believe that there are any rules or regulations or guardrails, doesn't even know anything about government. So it's not a big deal to him.
Right. And again, he fundamentally doesn't understand how government works. Mm-hmm. That's also a huge problem.
Absolutely.
Jim Santel, thank you for joining us. You can listen to
Always
Jim
a pleasure.
With the Amicus Law Review Saturdays, 9 a.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Time just flies by.
Jim, we'll see you next time. Appreciate it.
Do just that.
All right.
Stephanie Miller's coming up next. Also, tomorrow, Mike McCabe will join us. Yep. He's going to be talking about how to brace for the news cycle every day.
Wow.
Can't wait for that.
All right.
Have a great day. We'll talk to you in 22 hours right here.
Well, thank you.
WMDX. Yeah.
That's nice. Yeah. Thanks.
Okay.
I'll have a great day.
Yeah.
I know you meant that, right?
You want another cup of coffee?
No.
I think you've had enough.
No, I've had enough.
Let's go to beer.
Beer? Yeah.
The John and Gordy Show is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on WMDX weekday mornings from 6 until 8. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.